and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and in this week's show, I talk to a screen legend and two Oscar nominees who are both on strike, but are hoping it all ends so they can go to the party. Christopher Plummer talks about drink, work and life after The Sound of Music. I've got Tamara Jenkins, who was nominated for Original Screenplay earlier this week in Los Angeles, and whose terrific new film, The Savages, is released here this weekend. And there's Ronald Harwood, too, who got the nod for Adapted Screenplay for his work on the French memoir The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Plus, there's the welcome return of our DVD competition. It's all to come on a stellar and bumper Film Weekly. So, the Oscar nominations are unveiled. Not enough Sweeney Todd in there for my liking. It opens in your cinemas this weekend, and it's just fantastic, aesthetically, musically, and bloodily. Johnny Depp sings wonderfully well, a rock operetta star, if ever there were one, and Helena Bonham Carter is wonderful, as the music and the lyrics from Stephen Sondheim flow like a dark, witty river of blood. For my money, it's the best film, and it didn't even get a look in. Weird. Kudos, though, as they say in Los Angeles, to the Academy for respecting indie fare like No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. No Country's one of the Coen brothers' best films, both thrilling and funny, with a brave anti-climax of an ending. And There Will Be Blood is a right odd picture to be getting 8 nominations. It's really out there, and Daniel Day-Lewis is huge in it. But I do find it ultimately a rather bleak and unedifying picture, with a disappointing finale after so much good work. The best thing about it, perhaps, is the score by Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood. This is a truly original work, though the Academy disagreed and barred it at the last minute for quoting too many sources, apparently. All in all, it's a welcome set of nods with nary a special effect, hobbit, monster, alien, war or ship in sight. I suppose the gloss was taken off the Hollywood love-in last week by the news of the death of one of the Academy's own, the 2005 Best Actor nominee, Heath Ledger. I was genuinely shocked by the news of his death, as I think many of us were. He was good in Brokeback Mountain, very strong in the Aussie junkie drama Candy, and good fun in 10 Things I Hate About You. No doubt, though, his best work was to come. His Joker in the forthcoming Batman movie, Dark Knight, looks genuinely superb and unhinged. Later in the show, I talked to Christopher Plummer, who was working with Heath up until last Sunday here in London on poor Terry Gilliam's latest attempt to complete a film without a hitch. What will happen now to The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is unknown, as Heath still had half his filming to come and was back in New York on a quick break after weeks of night shoots in London. It's all very sad. Heath, of course, leaves behind a legacy of decent work, but also a young daughter who will only know her daddy through old movies. Let's lighten up now as we turn to our first Oscar nominee of the show, Tamara Jenkins. She scored a cult hit 9 years ago with the bitchy family comedy Slums of Beverly Hills, but has been off our radar ever since. She now returns with a well-deserved nom for her screenplay to The Savages, which she also directs with great command of tone and atmosphere. It's a bitterly comic tale of a bickering brother and sister, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman and the Best Actress nominee, Laura Linney, who have to pull together to decide on the fate of their increasingly frail father. They do neurotic battle over care homes and getting their own self-obsessed writings published, and one senses something very personal in it from the writer herself. It's very funny, if you like mordant wit and irony, which not everyone in America does, so it was particularly pleasing for me and for Tamara to get that nomination. I called her in New York and asked her where she was when she heard the news.
I had a shrink appointment that was scheduled anyway, so I went to see my shrink like I do on every, you know, on every Tuesday.
Yeah, you just sat down and said...
I sat down and I said, I quit. I'm fine now. I don't need you anymore. No, I'm kidding. No, I sat down and said, no, actually, she met me in the hall to let me into the office, and she had already found out about it, and she said, congratulations, and... You know, your shrink ends up being a person that you end up, you know, I was like talking about the writing of the script for however, 2 years. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I've got this, oh, now we're trying to get a finance. You know, they get, very,
of course. And
they're the inside scoop.
It's one of those films, you know, that therapy kind of, or at least kind of care is very strong in it. When I saw it, I thought it was almost about the way we look after ourselves, the way we look after our families, the way we look after our parents, the way and the way we kind of, you know, kind of neglect ourselves such a lot.
No, that's a good analysis.
Well, I'm not your shrink, but, you know, I'll give it a good go.
It's a good analysis. I think I'll lie down now and see what comes up.
No. I don't blame you after the exhausting day you must have had. But, I mean, I was thrilled. I was thrilled also to see, Tamara, that you, very unusually, there were three female nominees in your category, the original screenplay.
Yourself, Diablo Kobe, and also Sarah Pauly, who was the writer of, nominated for an adapted screenplay for Away From Her. So that was really exciting to be among all these. You know, I don't know. It was like apparently some historic watershed moment of this.
Of female empowerment?
Yeah, some massive women writing explosion. I don't know. It was exciting.
Well, I mean, these things take a long, it takes a long time to hit the top, Tamara. But 9 years, dear, is quite a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time between movies, that's for sure.
Because people will, I know it's rude, kind of rude to ask, but where have you been?
It's not rude to ask. It's like, what the heck have you been doing for 9 years? No, I was, this movie probably took 4 years or something like that. But the other 5 years, I worked on projects that never got financed, or I worked on a project that I didn't own with a producer for many years, and we separated ways, and he owned the project, and that was a sort of, a massive Bermuda Triangle.
Wow, no wonder you need therapy.
Yeah, exactly. So, I wasn't like in a coma or something, but I was trying to make movies, and I did other things when I got completely, disabled by the business, I directed theater and things to keep me sane,
Because, I have to say, I loved the movie. It was my favourite movie at the London Film Festival last November.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's an absolute pleasure. I mean, I kind of really enjoy it. It was so darkly kind of bitter and funny, and it strikes me that, it is darkly bitter. I think that Nancy Oliver's script for Lars and the Real Girl, that's kind of twisted too.
Right.
And Diablo Cody's for Juno, that's kind of pretty acerbic and there's a bit of bite to them.
That's an interesting portrait of all these movies.
Yes,
sure.
I don't know if there's a kind of female voice that's emerging from America.
I mean, they're all very character driven, and it's true that they have this kind of, I guess they're all portraits of people who are troubled. Maybe the environments are sort of, there's a, I don't know, bleak comic maybe or some sort
absolutely.
Of tone that I could see a similarity among them for sure.
Just tell us about the casting of your movie, how you got that cast together, because it's Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, and they are terrific together,
Tamara.
Yeah,
and Phil Bosco, who I also as the father. Isn't as known in England, but is a really very, very well-regarded theater actor in New York. Who doesn't do movies as much as he does theater.
Sure, I'd hardly see. I mean, he's one of those, I've seen that face before throughout the 70s, etc. But he's extraordinarily moving in the film.
Yeah, I love him in the film so much. And I sent, in the case of Laura and Phil, I don't have one of those, there's always these, indie film stories where people like run after actors or like throw scripts over their fence or, and hide out at cafes and try to introduce them. So I don't have any kind of cute meat story about that, but I sent it to their representatives and, crossed my fingers that it would get through the various gates and finally arrive at, in their apartments and that they would read it. And in both cases, they read them and they responded, and then I went and I met them individually one at a time, Laura first, and then a week later, Phil, and I got very excited about the idea of them together. I mean, that was so much the, assignment really was, obviously you want really strong actors, but the idea of the chemistry between the two actors and that these two actors could really just manufacture this sort of energy between these, siblings, and because the movie is such a study of, the dynamic of these two people, that was just really essential. And, and it's always this kind of leap of faith in a certain way, because I wasn't, auditioning them together in my, apartment or something. But you can kind of study their bodies of work and you meet them and you sort of get a sense of them, but you never really know until they're in the room together. It's like setting people up on a date or something, and you don't really know if that extra third party will arrive.
So did you audition them together? Did you have a sit down before?
No, I did not. They're actors of a stature where you're not really auditioning them. They have such huge bodies of work that, you study their work and send them the script and then meet with them.
Yeah. What's your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman moment?
In my movie or in his career?
First of all, first in his career and then in your movie.
I think one of the most striking things, and I remember Boogie Nights, him smashing his head against the steering wheel, calling himself an idiot.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I can feel it still, the pain.
Oh, it's so amazing. I had the pleasure of meeting Paul Thomas Anderson recently for, like, very brief minutes, and I was thinking how much I loved him in all those movies. In Boogie Nights, which was the first time I saw him in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. I guess he was in Hard 8. Was he in Hard 8?
He was in Hard 8, yes.
But I don't think I had seen that. I think I saw Boogie Nights first and then went back and found Hard 8. I loved him as the mattress man in
Punch Drunk Love.
Yes, in Punch Drunk Love, those just demented, hilarious, crazy, diabolical character.
I love him in Talented Mr. Ripley. Mr. Ripley, when he's like, "How's the peeping, Tommy?"
Oh yes, he's really is witty, and you know, it's such a tricky thing with. I mean, at least in terms of this movie, for me, you know, that the tone is both. You know, that there were all these sort of dramatic demands, but there's this, sense of humor that's coursing through the movie that I really needed actors that could straddle that. And I felt like they both exhibited those signs in their work, you know, that they were both really capable of the humor and the sort of demands of the kind of heavier emotional stuff.
Yeah, because you seem talking to you now. It's great. I mean, I loved Slums of Beverly Hills ages ago.
Ages ago. Ages to emphasize, ago. Italicized ages ago.
I've already asked you where you've been, so we kind of crossed that. I missed you.
Out.
All I'm saying is that I missed you. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, that's so nice.
And I was like, but you know, you sound. I know you've been having therapy, but you sound kind of chirpy and kind of good. But your characters are very bruised, Tamara.
Yeah, they are. I don't even think I realize it as much until the real world kind of responds to it. You know, I mean, I think that if you really look under the skin of lots of people, you know, there's a. But I think that in the case of these people, it's much more on the surface. Mm.
And let's go back to your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman moment in your movie, either on the camera and stuff that we've seen or off camera when you were just hanging out.
Stuff that I just thought he was so riveting and kind of, it is sort of a, you know, it's kind of like standing next to, you know, a natural resource or something like a waterfall or, you know, or if you've ever been to a basketball game in America, I've only been to like 2 professional basketball games. And once someone gave me seats very, very close. This is years ago, and I'm not even a basketball fanatic, but I was so stunned by the kind of beauty of what these basketball players were doing and sitting very close and sort of hearing the squeaking sneakers on the, you know, on the court and, you know, just these incredible, graceful, gorgeous, powerful, and such a unique, specific talent, you know, and I sort of feel like that about Phil. And, you know, there were lots of things, I mean, you know, from really tiny things. Okay, this is sort of a tiny thing. Phil's strapped to the door, you know, in that
The neck brace.
Traction device, yeah. And Laura Linney's character, Wendy, leaves and says, she wants to avoid the conversation. She says, "I'm starving. I'm going to get a tuna melt. Let's go, you know, we want a tuna melt?" And he's saying, when he's sort of probing her about the married boyfriend. And then he's sort of stuck there, and he's got this little pile of mail in his hands. And he's just, so the camera's still rolling. Essentially, it's done. And then we're going to call cut. But I'm standing there with the camera rolling, and he's sort of flipping through the mail in his hand after she leaves. He's like, "Fine, whatever." Flips through the mail in his hand. He's done with it. What does he do with it? He just stands there, and then he does this thing where he tries to toss all the envelopes onto the nearby radiator. It's just so hilarious.
And that was unscripted?
Unscripted.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you get.
He just kind of kept it rolling because there was all this stuff in there.
Brilliant.
And, you know, and then he just went for it, and it was almost like this class. It felt like I was watching, you know, some classic comic bit or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Tamara, you said you met Paul Thomas Anderson recently. You're going to see him again on Oscar night, I trust. You will be there?
Yeah.
Or are you on strike yourself?
Well, I am on strike. I'm in the Writers Guild, so we're all on strike. Everyone
but you're is. A director as well, so you've kind of reconciled yourself with yourself.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to go to double therapy this week. I'll have to go twice and figure it out, which part of me is which. But, yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. But, you know, the WGA is... You know, they're talking to the Alliance.
Sure.
Of,
but you, I mean, it's your big night, Tamara. You want to go to the Oscars, don't
you?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't want to go if, you know, if my WGA leaders don't want me to. But I think that there's things appear to be, we'll see what happens.
Are you fitting yourself for a dress? Have you got a dress?
No,
in
I have no dress. I'm sitting in my, like, sweatpants with my dog staring at me, like, wanting breakfast.
Well, you're going to have to dress up a bit more than that if
I
you want to go
down
the
red
carpet.
I don't think this would be a very good look.
Are you going to win?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's a, you know, there's a lot of really strong films. And I think that films that are have much broader, you know, that are much more out there. I mean, ours movie is kind of small. It's been a very small
release.
But actually, it's very exciting because now maybe more people will see
I it. Hope so, because I do think it's kind of, well, you know, as having spoken to you, it's a bit like therapy, your movie, in a way. There's a lot comes out of it, and I thought it was really good. I fell in love with it. I thought it was gorgeous, and I'm really pleased. From the opening shot, which was extraordinary, the L.A. kind of, the Palm Springs kind of sunshine, to the darker days in Jersey,
Buffalo.
I thought I loved it. It was a great journey. So I'm really pleased you could join us on the Observer Film Weekly, and congratulations on
Thank
being nominated.
You so much.
Best of luck. I'll see you in your sweatpants on the red carpet. Tamara Jenkins there. Her Savages opens this weekend. See it. My next nominee is Ronald Harwood. The South African-born writer has lived in the UK for years now and received his first Oscar nomination back in 1983 for The Dresser with Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. He actually won it 3 years ago for his moving screenplay to Roman Polanski's The Pianist, and now makes it a hat-trick with his adaptation of Jean-Dominique Bobby's best-selling blinked memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I met up with Ronnie to congratulate him and asked him if he was getting bored by the hype and glitz of being nominated.
No, I'm not blasé at all. I was terribly excited yesterday, and I tell you why, because I think it's such an unusual film to get any attention at all. It's in the French language. My script was translated into French, subtitled, which usually people resist, you know, and it's had this amazing amount of attention, especially in America. We've had nominations from every... I think we're in the top 10 list of 100 movie critics across America. It's amazing.
But, I mean, I saw it at Cannes. It's a French movie, as far as I was aware. It's a French book, a French movie. Matthew Almeric is wonderful in the lead. But it has this, you know, it has this kind of appeal that somehow has spread to America.
I don't know why. I mean, I wish if you knew why, it could be a gold miner or something. But I'll tell you what I think it is that people see this guy in this awful state. I mean, really appalling condition, totally paralyzed, able to blink only one eye, writes a book by blinking to an alphabet. And I think people think, how would I behave? How would I get through this awful agony? And somehow it touches them.
One of the things about your screenplay and about the original book is that it doesn't sugarcoat the man. He's not a particularly lovable man. It's not like, oh, look at the poor man, he's you know, he's disabled. I mean, he still flirts, he still looks at girls' breasts, and I think that's part of the appeal. There's a moral complexity to it.
Well, I think if we knew him before he had the stroke, we might not have liked him. I've always said that. And there's a curious irony in his life. He wanted always to write a book. He had a contract with a publisher. Then he had this massive stroke. It was when he wrote the book. I mean, it's awful. But he wasn't admirable before that. I mean, he had a kind of lifestyle that I don't really associate with. He was the editor of Elle magazine, lots of models, women, smart cars and money.
Well, you've been to Hollywood yourself, Ronnie. You know, you've played the games in Hollywood yourself. Do you go back to L.A. Often and kind of live that high life?
Jason, I've been married 49 years to the same woman. What are you talking about?
She deserves an Oscar.
She does. And I'm going to give her the next one. No, they make a hell of a fuss of you in L.A., much more than here. I mean, I'm much more courted and sweet-talked in Hollywood than I am in London. So, no, I love going, and I will go next 2 weeks' time or whatever it is. And I hope I have a lovely time.
You say you're going, and you say that obviously the writer in London lives in his garret and isn't well enough respected, I think, probably in the film industry. I think we respect our literary giants maybe better than they do in America. But the writers are obviously to the fore in America at the moment. You say you're going to go to the Oscars. Presumably you've got a feeling that the ceremony is going to go on.
My instinct tells me there are two things that are working for the strike to be settled. One is the Directors Guild settled with the producers. I'm not sure of what the terms of the settlement are, but nevertheless they settled. The other thing is the impending Oscar ceremony. You know, 100 million people watch the Oscars. It's worth $1.8 billion to the city of Los Angeles and the industry. I think the pressure is going to be terrific. Can you imagine now the telephone calls going between people, the messages, the texts, the emails? I think it'll be settled.
Are you a member of the Writers Guild?
I'm on strike.
You can't work at the moment here, even here?
I won't cross the picket line, no.
And doing it here counts as that, does it?
Well, it would. I mean, otherwise I'd be doing blackleg labour. I won't do that. I'm fortunate because I'm basically a playwright, and I've got a new play opening next month in Watford at the Palace Theatre, Watford, and then a new play in Chichester in July. So I'm busy in other ways. What it's about is being paid for what people download from the internet, and we think we ought to be paid for it.
Quite right. This is podcast is one of those things as well.
And you know, DVDs are obsolete already, so there's going to be a technology that we really don't know about, but we ought to have the principle agreed that we should be paid for it.
Well, you're a writer, and I love some of your more claustrophobic work, like Taking Sides, with this Van Zarbo movie that Harvey Keitel, that was taken from your play. You write sometimes very, very intense two-handers, if you like. I mean, I know that cinematic scope is something we like on the movie screen. Did you ever see your work being put onto a mobile phone and seen on tiny screens like that?
Well, I mean, I know Spielberg thought the idea of these tiny screens is appalling, but it's convenient. I mean, that's what's going to happen. Somebody told me the other day, he said, I watched Diving Bell. I said, how did you get his some illegal copy? You know, pirated copy already. I'm afraid that's the way it's going. And you know, you see it on a small screen, and then you go to a cinema and you see it on the proper screen, and it's an overwhelming experience. That's the whole point of the cinema. The images are so huge.
And you write? Do you write when you write for the cinema? When you're adapting, but when you're writing big cinematic things, do you think big?
I do, because that's how it is. I can't get. I mean, that's from my childhood. I didn't have podcasts when I was 12. And it is wonderful to look at a big movie. When you have a close shot of a man or woman's face, it's what's 10 times life size, and it goes right into you. It's one of the great things about the cinema.
Ronnie, I'm delighted for you for another nomination. I loved The Pianist. I loved The Dresser. What was it, 1982?
82 or 83, yeah.
And you enjoy going? It's a ceremony you like? Do you like the tuxedo, the kind of red carpet?
I do particularly. But I tell you what, it's nice to have won one, to have won an Oscar, because it doesn't so much matter. You know, you've been there and you've got that. And so, but I'm not blasé. I mean, it would be lovely to win too.
What's it like? Is it like a big bar mitzvah?
Not a broken glass.
Well, mazel tov and enjoy.
Thank you.
And so now to Christopher Plummer, who, at 78, stars in a new film this week, Man in the Chair, about a young film student in LA who meets a drunken old Hollywood electrician in a care home for old Hollywood types and persuades him and his cronies to help him make a short film. It's a sweet tale, if over-directed, but the script is neatly constructed and Plummer is a pleasure to watch as you realise perhaps we've never really seen the best of him on screen. I managed to track him down, rather faintly on a phone, I'm afraid, and he opened up the memory bank on a remarkable and colourful career, which seems busier than ever. I asked him if he was surprised by what looks like a late revival.
I know, it's absolutely wonderful. Ever since I hit 70, I've worked harder than I've worked all my life, I think. No, it's great. I'm terribly thrilled, because I love the job anyway. Even if it's miserable sometimes, I still love it. And I have a passion for it, so it's like a glorified hobby.
I must say that this film and Closing the Ring are the first time I've actually kind of seen you play an old man, if you see what I mean. Most of the part, you're always put in sort of senior positions, let's say, like in Inside Man.
A real old bum. Yeah. Now, that's much more me.
I mean, was there a while when you sort of say, I don't know, through some sort of wish to continue or, you know, not to sort of admit to old age, you kind of steer clear of those parts, and then suddenly you sort of say, do you know what, I am...
No. That feeling I had way back when I became a character actor, I would think that probably it was Rudyard Kipling in A Man Who Would Be King that was the first real character role I'd played on the screen. And that was a joyous discovery, because now I didn't have to worry about how my left profile looked or how my right profile looked.
Well, that's quite some time ago, Christopher.
Yes, it was 70, something like mid-70s.
75, I think, yeah.
So ever since I've played character roles of all sorts, and of course I'm always in the theatre in New York, and got tons of stuff there that are character roles. So I'm happy. I wasn't crazy about being a movie leading man at all. In those early days, it was rather boring, I thought. the character stuff is always rich.
Yeah, well, you always got stuck as a Nazi as well.
that brief while, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, I think when I was growing up as a kid, I thought you were a Nazi, I have to say.
Yeah, I think I am, actually, really. No, I was glad that those few years were over.
Yes.
I could have much more on the screen.
We can't sort of pass without sort of mentioning The Sound of Music. I know most people, you'd like to let it go, I should imagine. But
no, not really. It's just that as long as people talk about other things as well, it's when they only talk about The Sound of Music that I get annoyed. It's as if you had done nothing else in your entire life, and I've played all the great roles that have ever been written, practically. And I've done over 100 films, so some very good films. And I feel that when you only devote time to talk about that popular movie, which of course I don't mind talking about, only if the conversation goes to some other subjects.
For me, your great comeback, or the great sort of rediscovery of you, to me happened in Malcolm X, when you popped up in Spike Lee's film there.
Yes.
That was amazing to me. I mean, I wasn't expecting you to be in that film at all.
No, I wasn't either. And Spike Lee has been extremely loyal to me, and he's always asking me to do things. I did recently The Inside Man with him, which was quite a success.
Exactly, that's why I bring that back, because that was a wonderful kind of movie to be involved with, same like Denzel Washington and Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Same people, really, but very nice, yeah, terrific.
Do you notice a difference between the directors that you worked with when you were first trying to kind of be that the sort of young, handsome movie star, and the directors these days? How's the industry changed, or what the approach to filmmaking is?
The industry has vastly changed, and I think in many cases much for the better. I think in the 60s, everybody, with the exception of two or three really great directors, well, there was sort of ennui about making movies. We all were living it up royally off the screen, eating far too much lunches and drinking too much at lunchtime. And the movies, when you look at them now, the average 60s movies look terribly slow to me. The pace is so slow. Of course it was, because we were all sort of half-cocked.
Let's just talk very quickly about the Man in the Chair, which wasn't many people were saying it's kind of one of the finest performances of your career, and I kind of have to agree with him, because so often, certainly in latter times, you have important, crucial parts, but you're not the main sort of focus of the movie, if you like. Yeah. And here you really are a sort of
yes.
You know, it's a voyage round you in a way, and it must be very close to you as a part. You know, the what we're doing now, kind of reminiscing slightly about old Hollywood in a way, and
that's right, and also about all the drinking days that one had in the 50s and the early 60s, when it was a fashionable thing to drink. And so I grew up with the good old hefty Broadway pals like O'Toole and Jason Robards Jr. and all those big drinkers during that time. I was among them, and so I didn't have very far to research when I played Flash in this movie. No, that was easy.
Christopher, what was your tipple back in the day in the 50s?
I think it was just everything I could lay my hands on. It was that, you know, no one had a sort of very civilized attitude toward drinking. I only acquired that later on in life, where I stayed with wine. But in those days, it was martinis and vodka, and then scotch was my drink for a while, and then I switched to vodka, and then God, how we did it, I don't know, brandies afterwards, and Jesus, this went on. How one is still alive, I have absolutely no, I cannot fathom.
Who was the best? I mean, O'Toole's notorious,
well,
but he's still working.
O'Toole I knew when I was here, and I spent two nights at his house, I believe, at one party. And I don't remember where I was, and I don't think he knew that it was his house either. But I'm crazy about the man. He's such a unique personality. I love him. And Harris, I knew.
Yes.
And all of your English drinkers, Trevor Howard, I knew well. And Trevor, he was no mean shake for the bottle. All talented people, all enormously talented people who just loved life. And in those days, it was sort of a challenge to be a drinker for a man. You see, you weren't a man unless you could get on the stage still hungover and still get through in a marvellous way.
Christopher Plummer there. You can see him in Man in the Chair this weekend. Now there's just time left to tempt you lovely listeners into a little competition. We've got three copies of the newly released DVD, The Ghosts of Cité Soleil, a startlingly vibrant documentary about gang warfare in Haiti, shot with staggering bravery by some mad cameraman and director Asger Leth. You may recall I spoke to Asger on Film Weekly when the film was originally released here in the UK on very few screens, when it impressed me with its style and simmering energy. I asked him why on earth he went into the seething madness of the Cité Soleil ghettos.
Yeah, it was pretty hairy, you know, going in and out of the slum, but also crossing the front line of, you know, burning barricades and gangs, you know, with pickup trucks shooting at the car and so on, and then going up to the front line of the rebels, you know, and then back again, you know, this whole kind of scenario was pretty hairy.
Well, you can win a copy of this DVD of The Ghosts of Cité Soleil with its original soundtrack by that Fuji, Wyclef Jean. Just email me with the filmic connection between this documentary's director, Azgaleth, and the provocative Dogma director, Lars von Trier. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk and we'll read the winners out next week. Don't forget to join in the weekly debates on our blog pages at guardian.co.uk/podcasts or via the Film Weekly link on the Guardian and Observer web pages. And if you like what you hear and don't want to miss us, hit the subscribe button and you'll get us and our brilliant film guests delivered to your iTunes for free every week automatically. Can't say fairer than that, Governor. I'm Jason Solomons. Film Weekly is produced by Paul Noble. And until next week, we wish you all very happy viewing.